Well, hello there, everyone, and welcome to the Bubble Hour, where real people tell real stories of addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Jean McCarthy. I write the blog Unpickled, where I have been telling my story of life after alcohol since my first day of recovery and sobriety in 2011. I tell my story there, and I invite you to share your stories here. And my guest today is a woman in successful long-term recovery from alcohol addiction who is also a relationship expert, a personal coach, a podcaster, and author of the book Relationship Ready, which is a memoir and workbook in which she shares her personal story of recovery from alcohol use disorder and also how she prepared herself for a more meaningful and fulfilling relationship. Please welcome Heidi Bushy to the Bubble Hour. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Jean. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm glad to have you, and I really enjoyed reading your book, and you do a lot of things, which I can really appreciate, that it takes a lot of energy to do a lot of things, but some of us are just kind of excited about helping others and sharing the message and, you know, just have a heart for talking it out and shining a light. So that seems to be...
Oh, my gosh.
How you roll. Does that sound
That's
about right?
Truth. And I have to say, I feel so blessed because all the things I do are things I love to do. So it's really easy to find the energy to do the stuff that it's like right in my purpose and really aligned with who I am. So I'm really thrilled to be on your show today, and I really appreciate you sharing your platform with me.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I look forward to hearing your share today. So let's jump right in. Tell us about yourself, Heidi. Tell us your story.
Sure. Okay, so I'm Heidi, and I'm an alcoholic. I identify as alcoholic. My sobriety date is 9/10/11, and I got sober when I was 31 years old. And to anyone that's listening today, I hope that if you're struggling with the way you drink alcohol or, I guess, use drugs, that I hope you hear something you can identify with. So I grew up in an alcoholic family, and I really sometimes wish it was, like, just that easy. Like, oh, my parents are alcoholics, so I'm an alcoholic, you know. But that was not the case for me. It took me a long time to figure out that my drinking wasn't working for me and that I needed to do something about it. So, but growing up in the house I grew up in, was really, really fun. For a long time, my parents drank in a way that allowed them to have a good time and that they didn't really have any consequences to. And so, as a kid, I was very, very shy. And I remember feeling like, oh my God, I can't wait until I'm old enough to do this too. And to like just fit in with everyone and like have a great party and have all these people having a lot of fun. And so I really kind of aspired to this party lifestyle. I mean, we grew up in the middle of Iowa. It wasn't like we were in New York City partying in Manhattan. It was like, you know, a block party or two every summer, just like really kind of mundane stuff, but they always looked like they were having so much fun. And as a kid who felt very shy and kind of like afraid all the time, and I just kind of always wanted to be absorbed by the wallpaper around me, it was kind of a new idea, like, oh, when I get older, I'll be able to have fun like these guys have fun, you know? And so as a kid, I remember just watching that and feeling that way. And then by the time I was 15 or so, by the time I'd reached my teenage years, my parents did start to have some consequences to their drinking. And so like my dad got fired from a job over it, and stuff was kind of rocky at home. And I remember at that stage thinking, or maybe a little bit earlier than that, thinking like, well, I can't drink like them. I got to make sure that I don't drink the way that, you know, it kind of flipped, where I was like, I need to do everything I can to not be an alcoholic, but I was still curious about drinking. So, you know, I started at that stage to be like a very high achieving student, getting straight A's in school, being on the debate team, playing some sports, singing. I was like really into all of the stuff as a way to kind of just willpower my way past what I thought was potentially in store for me, i.e. like becoming like them. So I was wound pretty tight by the time I was 15. And I took my first drink at 15 with a bunch of friends who, you know, we had one friend who could grow a beard. And so he bought us a six pack, and we went over to another friend's basement, and we split it between three of us. And I blacked out the first time I drank, and I had a great time the next day hearing from everyone like how funny it was, and like, oh, we all had such a great time. And I really started to kind of develop this double life of like, you know, goody two shoes at school, and then on the weekends kind of drinking to blackout almost every weekend. And I was able to get alcohol at that stage because my dad was alcoholic And so there was always a giant bottle of vodka or two or whatever at our house. And I could always just like take some out of, I hear people talk about stealing alcohol from their parents and replacing it with water, but my parents didn't know, they were not keeping track of what kind of alcohol they had. So I would just like steal some of their alcohol after they went to bed. And by the weekend, I'd have like a whole water bottle of alcohol to drink with my friends. So I was able to kind of manage stuff. As a teenager, you know, I graduated from high school, I got into college, I went to college, and like my life started to happen. Like life really got in session when I went away to school. I attended the University of Pittsburgh, and I went there when I was 18. And what happened for me right before I left was my mom actually bottomed out with her own drinking, and she had a suicide attempt that she attempted while she was blackout drunk. And she ended up being committed to a 28-day spin dry, and then she did 12-step recovery, and she's been sober ever since. She has probably 23 years of continuous sobriety. And so that happened, and that was pretty tumultuous to experience that and head off to school. And then the other thing that happened was my parents got divorced. My mom told my dad that she couldn't stay together with him if he continued to drink, and he decided to keep drinking. So eventually what happened was, kind of fast forward a little bit, you know, and all this time I drank and I went to school, and like I had some dark periods, and I started to notice that like my drinking did not look like everyone else's drinking. I especially could never understand why, like, once we started drinking, we would ever stop. Like I felt like even if we went out to the bars and started drinking, like, and it closed, the bars closed at 2, shouldn't we just like go pick up a 24 pack, a case, and like keep drinking at home? I could do a couple of days without, but once we started, I just wanted to keep going all kind of just like it all out, you know? And it was interesting because once I got sober, in the moment, I really felt like, oh, I drink pretty normal. I drink differently than these other kids, but I don't drink all the time. And I definitely don't drink the way that my dad drinks. So, you know, it's fine. But once I had a couple of years sober, I realized I actually, during my 20s, I drank probably every single night because I was at this, you know, I was at a school that was far away from my parents, and that was far, you know, I was scared and didn't know what to do with myself. So I just would drink every night, and there was stuff to do. There were drinks to be had every night. So it was like Monday night was bucket night. Tuesday night was was penny shots. Wednesday night was some other kind of promo. Thursday night was weekend. Friday night was weekend. Saturday night was weekend. Sunday night was like recover from the weekend and have a Bloody Mary. So it was like in the moment, I didn't realize I knew I was drinking differently than my peers. I didn't realize I was drinking every day, but I was. And so what would happen to me in my 20s is like I would go out with my friends, and then I would come home at night, and then I would like pull the journal out. And I like to call these like my death journals, because I would just start writing. I would be drunk and I would just start writing like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't fix this. I don't want to be like my parents. I don't know. You know, I just like kind of this rambling, but I would always start off writing across the page. And then of course the pen would run out of ink, and I'd like grab a lip liner and turn the journal sideways and write down the margin, and just really dramatic stuff, you know? And so I made it through my university years with some really dark periods. I bottomed out a couple times. I probably could have gotten sober at that stage, but I wasn't ready. And one of the things I love is I have a friend who says all the time, like, when we're not ready, nothing makes sense. You know, we can't hear anything anyone says. Nothing makes sense. But when we're ready, like, nobody can say anything wrong. And this was true for me because in my 20s, I was court ordered to attend 12-step meetings. I couldn't identify with what was going on there. And I just ended up forging all my signatures on my court card and submitting it because I just couldn't hear and I couldn't identify with what was going on. So I ended up making it through university. It took me 5 years instead of 4, but I graduated with a degree. And a couple years later, and I married, I found someone who would marry me, which I really felt like that would change my situation. I married a guy who was Irish, who I barely knew. I dated him for 8 months, but we dated long distance the entire time. And I just kind of felt like, well, all my friends are doing this. Like, this is what I should do too. And I didn't want to be left out. And so I married this guy at 24, maybe 25. I was 24 when I got married to him. So 24 when I got married, and I felt like, okay, I'm doing life. Like, this is what people do. And when I was 28, my dad died from his alcoholism, which was a really, it was a shock to me. Even though I knew he was drinking the way that he was drinking, And he was an alcoholic that was kind of chained to the bottle. So he would drink all day, every day. There was a time at our house when growing up, when like cocktail hour would start at 4:30. But by the end of my dad's life, he would drink, you know, 4:30, 6:30 PM, 8:30 PM, 10:30, you know, he just needed to have a drink every 2 hours so that he didn't end up in delirium tremens withdrawal. So the most shocking part about my dad passing from his alcoholism was that when we went to go clean out his house, we looked at the kitchen table and I looked at it closely and I could see that he had worn away the veneer, the varnish on the table in the shape of two forearms, because for years he had sat there just drinking vodka on the rocks out of a glass and smoking cigarettes. And it was like such a shocking visual to me that I'll never forget that. So, you know, that happened when I was 28 and I still continued to drink after that, especially because my drinking did not look the way my dad's drinking looked. And so I kind of, the grief that I experienced from losing my dad really did a number on my marriage. And I ended up getting divorced when I was 30 years old. And I spent really one last year kind of out ripping and running and doing what I wanted to. I left my marriage at 30, decided that, you know, I should just drink the way that I want to drink, party the way I want to party. I'm young, I'm single, I'm going to go out and do this. And so I did all kinds of stuff, but one of the stories I think is just like so classic. It's like such a, you know, I write about it in the book too. It's like, you know, one of the first times I went out after I was single, I went down to this place called the Portland City Grill and I met this guy there and I started flirting with him or whatever. And, you know, and after a few drinks, I decided to get in the car with him and we went to his house, which was like a drive. I shouldn't have been in the car with him. He shouldn't have been driving. I was definitely not fit to drive. And we got to his place and we messed around a little bit. And then, you know, it was like 4 a.m. and I realized that his kid was going to come over. His ex was going to drop his kid over at 8. And I thought, oh my God, I cannot be here. So I pulled my phone out because I didn't know where I was. And I hit up Google Maps and I looked at it and I'm like, okay, I found an address on Google Maps. So I called a cab because this is pre Uber and Lyft. So I called a cab and the cab, I gave them the address that I was at and hung up the phone and just went and collected my stuff. And the guy called me back a couple minutes later and he's like, did you say you're at this address? And I'm like, yeah, that's where I'm at. And he's like, well, it doesn't exist. And I said, like, listen, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I had to Google Maps myself to even find this address for you. So, like, I don't know what else to give you. And he was like, are you at someone's house? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, do you know them? And I'm like, no. And he's like, okay, go to the kitchen. People always keep mail in their kitchen. And I was like, oh, my God, okay. So this guy kind of led me on this wild goose chase through this stranger's kitchen. And eventually I opened up enough drawers. I found some mail that had this guy's address on it. I gave the cab driver the address and he came and picked me up and he didn't charge me for the ride home, which was very nice of him. But like all kinds of stuff like that happened to me where it was like, I knew that that wasn't happening to people who drank normally. And yet I was compelled to always drink. Like it was really kind of my go-to, whether I was happy or sad or anxious or fearful. I just always kind of, I drank and drank. And so in the last year, between 30 and 31, after I'd gotten divorced, after stuff like that kept happening to me, I did start to try to control my drinking. And one of the ways I did that was by compulsive exercise. So I was, you know, I was constantly at the gym because I just kind of felt like nobody who worked out like me could possibly have a problematic relationship with alcohol. So, you know, I was like running 6 to 7 miles on the treadmill or whatever, and always in a yoga class, always on the treadmill, always just doing any of the things I could do to make my life seem like it was normal. I was also in grad school. I had completed a master's degree. I was working on a PhD at this time and really like doing everything I could to keep the facade up. But the gym was hilarious because every day I would go into the gym, I would change my clothes, I'd use the bathroom. And in the stalls, there was a flyer from a woman who played racquetball and was looking for a racquetball partner. And so it always said like, do you play racquetball? I'm looking for a racquetball partner. If so, you know, call me at this number. And it had her name and her number and like those little, the way flyers used to be where you just like tear the number off so you could call them. And I always just thought like, oh my God, this lady needs a racquetball partner so bad. But I never called her and I never, because I was not a racquetball player. So anyway, what happened for me is that another year, you know, I drank really the way that I thought I wanted to for a long time, for another year. And finally, you know, I have to say that my sobriety date is 9, 10, 11, but it wasn't anything in particularly dramatic that happened to me on 9-9. A friend of mine and I went out, we drank a lot, we came home, and I don't know, I woke up on 9, 10, 11, and I had a moment of clarity, I guess is what we call it in 12-step recovery. I had a moment of clarity where I realized, like, I am either going to drink myself to death like my father, or I'm going to have to get sober. And it became really clear to me, kind of the level up version of that was like, and if I drink myself to death, it's going to take 30 years. I'm going to end up drinking myself to death, sitting in my kitchen at the table alone, drinking. You know, that I would be lucky if I got in a car wreck, drunk and died, that I would be lucky to die, you know, in some kind of awful way, because what was really probably waiting for me was another 3 decades of isolated drinking by myself. And that was enough to make me go like, oh, geez, like, mercy, uncle, I give, you know, and that was like at 8:30 in the morning. So of course by noon I was like, well, maybe I've overcorrected. I'm not really sure I need to do this. And so I decided that I would just try not to drink that day. Now I had a friend that I was living with that was going to a 12-step meeting for people who are in relationships with alcoholics. And she was like, oh, do you want to go to this meeting with me? And I said, well, I guess I'll try that. And it was not my primary. I can say today, like, I definitely belong in those meetings today, but it was not my primary problem at the time. So I went there and it didn't really identify. Nothing really landed for me, but I did stay sober. And so I was like, okay, well, that was a day. And then the next day I decided I would just like try to kind of white knuckle it. And then the third day I was really surprised because I felt for sure like I was going to kill someone if I didn't have a drink. And at the time I was really struggling with what my alcohol use looked like because I really couldn't believe myself that way. How could someone who has a house, who has a car, who has a job, who's getting a PhD, how could someone like that feel like she's going to kill someone if she hasn't had a drink in 3 days? And yet I felt that way very, like in a very visceral way. So what happened for me was I decided that I would go to a 12-step meeting and I spent some time deciding which one I would go to. And I found one that was happening at a university that was close to me. And I felt like, oh, I won't have to do anything. There won't be any talk of anything that's like uncomfortable for me, like a God concept or spirituality component or any of that stuff. And so I decided I would go to that meeting. And I have to back up a little bit because one of the other things I was doing in kind of my end of days was that I had been compulsively dating. So I had been on like, you know, in the States, there are all these apps like OkCupid and Puddle of Fish. I don't think that's what it's called, but I can't remember what it's called, you know, and like Tinder wasn't around yet, but it was coming and eHarmony and all. So I was been like compulsively dating just to try to like kind of keep it together. And I had gone on a date a couple of weeks prior to this with a guy who had wanted to meet me for coffee. And I had felt like, why in the world would we meet for coffee? I don't understand. But I did. I met him for coffee. And when I got there, he was happily finished with his coffee. And I got my coffee. We sat down and he finished his coffee. And he was like, oh, I'm going to go get another coffee. And I said, you know what? Like, this isn't going to work. I'll see you never. And I was pretty rude to him and left. And so this day, fast forward now a couple of weeks, and I'm like 3 days sober. And I've been, you know, kind of chain smoking cigarettes. I haven't showered in 3 days. I finally hit this like really like desperation moment where I realized like, I just don't think I can do this by myself. So I was just willing to go to a 12-step meeting. So I found this particular meeting and I went there and I walked in the door and that guy, the coffee guy, was standing there greeting people. And he was like, how are you? And I was like, how am I? How do you think I am? I'm 31. I'm at a 12-step meeting. I can't believe this. My life is over. This is a nightmare. I mean, I just kind of like let him have all of it, you know? And he was just like, well, come on in and sit down. And I did. I sat down and I listened to what people were saying. And that very first day, you know, I could not identify as an alcoholic. I raised my hand. I said I was Heidi. I was willing to say I was new, but I was not willing to say that I was alcoholic. And that kind of in hindsight is another thing that I think is so interesting. Like, wouldn't it be amazing if it was really just so easy as saying, I'm Heidi, I'm alcoholic, and then I'd never have to drink again? And my experience has not been that way. You know, I've had to do a lot of work around my addiction, my alcoholism, in order to make my life, in order to have a life that I love living. It's not as easy as just identifying as alcoholic. So anyway, I did sit through the meeting, but then I decided I couldn't go to that meeting anymore. So I needed to find a different meeting for the next day. But that meeting did its job. I stayed sober that night. I went home and I went to bed sober. And then the next day I found a meeting in a different spot because I decided I couldn't go back to that one. So I found a different meeting and I got to the meeting on time. And when I arrived, there were no chairs, there were no people, there were no treats, there was no coffee, there was nothing. And I'm telling you this because for two reasons I like to tell this story. One is that some people find a method of recovery that works almost immediately. And that's an amazing, I'm glad that that works, that that happens to people. Some people like myself have to try a few things before they find something that fits. And also, like, I had literally no skills to cope with anything when I found myself getting sober at 31. So I got to this meeting. Again, I was super agitated, feeling uncomfortable. I arrived at the meeting. There's nobody there. There's no coffee. There's no snacks. I just, and all I could do was stomp around. I literally threw a temper tantrum like a child. I crossed my arms. I stomped around. I huffed and puffed until somebody finally came over to me and said, "Hey, are you okay?" And I was like, "Well, I don't know. I think I might drink tonight. I don't know what to do." And they said, "Well, like, do you think a 12-step meeting that's not related to alcohol would help you with that?" And I said, "Well, like, I guess so." So I ended up, I found myself in a Codependence Anonymous meeting that night. And those people were very, very nice. And they weren't just nice because they were like trying to take care of me because I was alcoholic. They were just really, really patient and kind and tolerant. And I found myself in that meeting feeling like I didn't want to identify with them. So I was willing to raise my hand up and say, "I'm Heidi, I'm an alcoholic." But I was so crazed that I was like, "I am not like you. You know, alcoholics are the apex predators of the addiction pyramid. We are the great white sharks of the food chain of, you know," I just was so crazy. And they let me sit in their meeting. And afterwards, one of their members came up to me and said, "You know, I'm in another 12-step program. And I think I can relate to what you're talking about. And why don't we go walk around the block and see if I can't just help you stay sober tonight." And that guy was great. He wasn't, one of the things I have to say is, like, he wasn't hitting on me. He did not ask me for my phone number. He was actually waiting for his boyfriend to get out of something else that was happening in the same spot. And he walked me around and I was able to stay sober that night. You know, he just listened to me talk. And then he said, "You know, do you think you can go home and stay sober tonight?" And I said, I think I can. And I did. And then I had to go to a couple more meetings. You know, I had to have this experience where I felt like 12-step meetings could keep me sober, but I didn't feel comfortable at any of the ones I went to until I finally found one that I felt like I fit in. And so my message around that is just like, you know, if you think 12-step recovery might be something you want to explore, keep trying different meetings until you find something that works for you. And so I was in this meeting that was taking place. It was a daily meeting, and I started to, like, get some days together. And but I had not found anyone to do, you know, what they talk about the steps with. I hadn't found anyone to do the steps with. So somebody grabbed my hand one day and was like, "Oh, do you have a sponsor to work the steps with?" And I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Oh, why don't you meet, you should meet my friend over here." And so he introduced me to this woman. And she was like, "Okay, do you want to work the steps?" And I was like, "Okay, I guess I do." And she was like, "Okay, great. I'll do that with you." And I said, like, "Are you my sponsor?" And she's like, "I guess I am," you know, and that was really how it worked. And I met with her every week and we started doing 12 steps of recovery. And it was really pretty funny because, we were talking one day and, you know, I'm like, her name was Cynthia. I'm like, "Cynthia, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. We're talking about whatever it is." And she's like, "You know, this isn't 12-step recovery related. It's not 12-step related, but I have been looking for a racquetball partner for a really long time. And I know you're pretty athletic. Would you be willing to play racquetball with me?" And I'm like, oh my God, the woman, Cynthia, who was my first sponsor in 12-step recovery, was the same woman who a year and a half prior had been looking for a racquetball partner in the gym that I'd been going to for a whole year before I got sober, you know? So it's like, this woman had been in my life for years before I even realized that she was there. And the beautiful thing was that when I was ready to change my life, she helped me do the work that was necessary to have a life that is incredible today. So I always love that little twist to the story that, you know, I did end up playing racquetball with Cynthia anyway, even though, you know, years earlier I'd felt so much pity for her trying to find a racquetball partner. So we did that. And, you know, one of the things that happened for me was about a couple weeks, maybe 3 weeks into sobriety, I felt like I had overcorrected. I really felt like I feel better. My bank account's out of the red. Everybody's off my back. Nobody's mad at me anymore. Like, I don't know. I really don't know if I need to keep doing this. And people that I had heard in sobriety had said, like, "You need to talk about what's going on for you." And so I was at this meeting that was a podium meeting, meaning you have to, like, go up to a microphone and a podium and share what's going on for you. And I said to them, you guys, you've all been very nice to me. Thank you so much for helping me with all of this stuff, but I actually think I've overcorrected and I really don't think I need to be sober anymore. And after the meeting, a couple of women came up to me and said, like, you know, you can do whatever you want to do, but before you decide to drink again, you really should pray about this. So I didn't know how to pray because I mean, I'd gone to church as a kid, but I had like kind of an aversion to like all the formal prayer work. So I decided to go home that night and just say, you know what, universe, higher power, God, whatever energy that's out there, I am so screwed. And that was my prayer. It's the simplest prayer. I still love it because it doesn't ask for any particular outcome. It just says, like, I need help. I'm so screwed. I need your help. That's basically what I said. I don't know what to do. And I went to sleep. And that night I had a dream where I was talking to my dad, who had been dead for probably, let's see, 3 years at this stage. So I talked to my dad in this dream, and I was telling him that I was getting sober. And in the dream, he said back to me, Heidi, I'm so happy for you. And of course, I woke up crying. I mean, I was just like all emotions, all tears. And I decided, I'm just going to keep doing this thing. Whether I've overcorrected or not, right now, a life of sobriety is better than this constant chaos I'm living in when I drink. And the reality is, like, the bar is always going to be there. So if I decide in a year or 5 years or 10 years that I want to go drink, I always know where I can go to do that. So that was kind of a turning point for me where I really started to kind of just lean in and surrender to the fact that, like, I was going to try something different. It was going to be sobriety, and that it was probably, even if it wasn't necessary, it was going to be a better way of living my life, which that has turned out to be true. You know, when I talk at 12-step meetings, I like to talk a little bit about what the steps do, and I don't have a ton of time left, but I do want to just kind of mention a little bit about what they are for and what happens. And the reality is, you know, the first step basically just says, like, my life is unmanageable. I cannot control all the stuff that's happening in my life. And the second step suggests that we find a willingness to consider a spiritual solution to that. And for me, for a long time, I had an aversion to kind of my old idea of God because I'd been raised in a religious household, Presbyterian, and I had been disappointed by that religion. And I felt like, oh, I don't want to do that. And so somebody was like, well, why don't you try something different? And I thought, well, like, what do you mean? And they were like, well, it just has to be a power of some kind that's bigger than you, that's not you. And I said, okay, well, like, you know, if I was in a helicopter and I was over the ocean and I got kicked out of the helicopter and I landed in the ocean, I would either like sink, I would either drown or like a shark would come eat me, which is like a very dark concept of a higher power over something that's bigger than me. But I was on board with it. I could believe that the ocean was bigger than me and that it was powerful in some sense. So I rode with that for a long time. And eventually I shifted into a space where love became a power greater than myself. And that's an incredible story. I think it's in the book. And it just was like a moment. I had another moment of clarity where my perspective was shifted again, and I started to believe in the power of love, you know, and that really is what I believe in today. And then in the third step of, you know, the 12 steps, the third step talks about trying to align my will with the will of like this spirit of the universe or the power of love. And I didn't really know what that meant. And that's something that I know I got stuck on for a long time, but somebody explained it to me like this, like my job was to take the next right action, which was to stay sober, to show up in my life, honest, loving, tolerant, kind, and sober. And that it was the universe's job or whatever to take care of the outcome. And that gave me a lot of freedom. When I'm not worrying about the outcomes of everything all the time, I have a lot more space to do stuff that I love to do. And even when I couldn't get on board with that suggestion, I realized that like, I don't have to know exactly what a higher power or universal spirit's will is for me, but I'm pretty sure that it's not to like sit on a bar stool all day and get so drunk I'm blacked out and talk to people, you know, who I don't even like remember talking to the next day, right? And then I got to do an inventory process, which can be really scary for people who are new to recovery or new to 12-step recovery. But basically it was like I had worked retail for a lot of years, and somebody explained it to me like, look, this is just as if you were working retail. All you need to do is you need to know what defects of your character cause you wreckage in your life. So it's basically the moral equivalent, not the moral, the kind of like character assessment equivalent of like going to the manager at a store and being like, do you have these pants in a size 8 black? You know, I just needed to know what I was working with, what my character defects were that like come out in ways that really mess up my life. And so that got me through the fourth and the fifth step, which was sharing all that stuff with someone else. And then in the sixth and seventh step, I got the opportunity to learn how to live my life differently, because I really believe that, you know, if I continue to just live my life the same way, but just without alcohol, I will undoubtedly find myself in situations that are really painful, and I won't have any anesthetic for that pain, right? So I have to learn to live my life differently so that I don't find myself in constant pain that requires an anesthetic that I can't use anymore. So the six and seven steps really taught me how to like behave differently in my life. And for me, that was learning how to show up honestly. It was learning how to be on time, learning how to maintain commitment, learning how to be of service to friends and family. So I got to learn how to live my life a little bit differently than I had been. And then because I had done that work to create different behaviors, in the eighth step, I got to make a list of persons that I had harmed. And in the ninth step, when it wouldn't cause them any additional harm, I got the opportunity to go to them, to apologize for the harm I had caused, and to let them know that I had amended my behavior because I'd done the work in the sixth and seventh step to start to live a new way, to live differently. And then in the 10th step, I get to do a nightly inventory or a weekly inventory of like what's going on in my life, like what kind of character defects are popping up and causing me trouble. And then the 11th step, I get to develop a meditation practice that helps me stay close to this, you know, power that's bigger than me. And then the 12th step, I get to pass it on, which I have gotten to do here today. And I get to do in my life all the time when I speak at events or speak at 12-step meetings or help people kind of find any path of recovery. But what I've really learned is that, like, you know, what I've learned, especially 8 years in now, is that, like, you know, there is no monopoly on recovery. The literature in 12-step mentions that as well. You know, whatever it is that gets you and keeps you sober and sane, I feel like is just, like, what you should chase. Because for me, 12-step recovery has worked, but that's not everyone's story. And so I just really feel like, you know, if you're someone out there who's struggling with your relationship to alcohol and the way it affects your life, like there's probably a reason that you're curious about that relationship. And I would encourage you to explore all kinds of different modalities of recovery in order to live a life where you're not chained to a bottle. So I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to be on the show and to share my story with your listeners. Thank you so much, Jane.
Oh, thank you, Heidi. I read something in your book that I hadn't heard before in, you know, the sayings that we hear in recovery. Sometimes sure. They're annoying, and sometimes what's annoying about them is that they're so spot on, and yet you're like, oh, darn it, they did it again, they got me again. So I wasn't sure if this was something, you know, a recoveryism that I just hadn't heard or something that you wrote, but it was where you said, willingness is not the same thing as wantingness. Can you talk about and what that means to you?
Yeah, that's a good one. I don't know that that's mine necessarily. It's not it, but you're right. It isn't a common, saying in 12-step recovery, but I do think that at some stage, no, I'll only speak for myself. What happened for me was I was pretty willing to get sober because this moment of clarity I had was so stark. And it was just like, oh, it's really easy. It's actually pretty easy to do stuff that I'm willing to do. I can be kind of mad about it. I can throw a temper tantrum about it. But it's like, it's pretty easy to do stuff that I want to do anyway. But what happened for me was, you know, at 2 years sober, I also bottomed out with men in relationships. And at that stage, you know, it was suggested to me that I do some more work around men in relationships. And I was like, I don't want to. I do not want, like, I don't drink. I don't do drugs. I don't steal stuff. Like, I don't want to do this. But the suggestion was made to me by someone that I trusted deeply and who had relationships in her life that I aspired to. She had sustainable, long-term, loving relationships, which was not something that I had. So I always qualify this because it is not Well People's Anonymous, right? 12-step programs, everyone is at a different stage of recovery when they get there. So, like, I do not think that anyone should just, like, blanket statement trust everyone there. I do not think that. I think you should, you know, kind of vet the information you're getting. And if it's coming from someone who looks like they're sober and sane and has something you want, then, like, you should consider it. So this woman had those things, and I realized I had to consider the suggestion she was giving me. And I was like, I do not want to do this. There's nothing about this that I want to do, but I know that if I do it, I will feel differently and I'll have a new experience in my life. And so I found that was willingness, doing something that I really, really didn't want to do, was much different than doing something that I kind of already enjoyed doing anyway. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And even the fact that you said, like, you wanted to have the kind of relationships that this other woman had, but you weren't necessarily willing to give up having, you know, a really active dating life and being kind of quick to jump into relationships with men or to have, you know, intimate relationships with men really quickly because it's fun.
And yeah, I was having a great time until I wasn't. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what's the overlap there? Yeah. What do you see as there being some overlap there between addiction and sort of serial dating or having superficial relationships that aren't fulfilling? Whether that's something you see as a pattern in other people that you help or specific to yourself. What have you learned about that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was very definitely like another tool that I was using to kind of just fill this emptiness that I was feeling. So, you know, I had this kind of extreme lonesomeness and this extreme kind of like, I don't fit in or nobody likes me my whole life. And then I started to fill that with alcohol and drugs and, you know, partying and all this stuff. And then take that away. And it's like, okay, I still kind of filled it with compulsive exercise. And because I compulsively exercised into early sobriety as well. Even though I had been doing that before I got sober, I continued to do it in early sobriety because it was better than drinking. But it was also kind of just filling this emptiness that I was feeling. And you can fill with all kinds of stuff, shopping, exercise, food, men. And I think to some degree, I can only speak for myself. And I did, so I will say like, to varying degrees, I filled that emptiness with all of those things. But what caused me the most pain was filling that emptiness and that like kind of lost sense of self and that not wholeness that was in there. The thing that caused me the most pain was trying to fill that with men and relationships. And eventually it got so painful that I had to look at that or else I was going to drink over it. And I knew I didn't, I mean, I kind of, you know, I knew it wouldn't be good to drink over. Because then I knew I'd be like, you know, everything would be on fire. So I had enough clarity to go, all right, look, if I don't do something different about the way I approach men in relationships, I'm going to get drunk over it. And I need to find a different way to do this. So I don't know. I work with women who also struggle with this. I also work with women that don't. So I hate to say that it's something that everyone struggles with, but I will say that like, it's not surprising if you've had a distorted relationship with alcohol. Like I had a distorted relationship with alcohol since the time I was 15. So it's like not really surprising that at 31, I didn't have any tools to have sustainable, long-term, loving relationships because I hadn't really been having them my whole life. I didn't have any practice at it really, you know?
And ironically, you wound up in a meeting of Codependence Anonymous and said, yeah. I don't belong here.
yeah,
so given
exactly.
Codependency is sometimes called the disease of the lost self. Can you talk about how maybe you've learned that? Oh, maybe you did fit in there more than you thought.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, I will say I never have actually worked a Codependence Anonymous program, but I certainly do know that I would fit in there. And if the time came, that it would be probably a good solution to the problem to a problem I'm experiencing. But, you know, talk about it in the book a little bit. In drinking I did this, but I really got into doing it when I was sober, which was that like I always wanted to manage everyone's response to me. So like I found myself in my first marriage, you know, always walking on eggshells because I always wanted to manage how I said something. I wanted to be able to say it just right so that it would land just right with my ex-husband and then his response would be just right. You know, it's like I feel like codependence and that enmeshment is really about so much managing. How can I just make everyone do what I want them to do? How can I make them all happy? How can I make sure that I only communicate in a way that makes everyone else okay? And it was a huge, huge shift to go, look, everyone's going to be fine. Everyone's going to be okay. Some people are not going to like it that you've been, you know, that we've been doing the tango all these years and now I want to do the waltz because now I want to come to you and just tell you how I feel, without managing it or presenting it in any way that would manage your response to me. Does that make sense?
Oh, well, it makes a lot of sense to me because I was I was queen of the people pleasers.
Oh,
and it's
too.
Manipulation,
so
right? I mean, it's very pleasant manipulation, but it is manipulation at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And, that can
me,
be.
I ended up feeling like, oh, I'm sorry, you go first.
Oh, no, I'm much more interested in what you have to say.
Well, for me, it ended up making me feel like I was suffocating. You know, I ended up leaving my first marriage because I just felt like I am suffocating because I can't actually, because I'm such a people pleaser. I'm so glad you reminded me of that phrase because that's so much what it's about. I'm so people pleasy that I can't even surface to breathe any air and tell you what I really feel or think about something. Instead, it has to be said in just the right way. So, I mean, it's actually really interesting because today, I know that when I start to feel that way of like, oh my God, I feel like I'm suffocating a little bit. I need to check myself on who it is that I'm people pleasing.
That's such a good point because, I think it's very common in recovery circles to hear women in particular who have struggled with this and who drank to numb the discomfort of it. And you think, what's wrong with me? Like I'm being nice or why should, what's wrong that I feel resentment about this? Like I'm being good. I'm being nice. But yeah, it really is. It's dishonoring ourselves when we are shape-shifting to please others so that we can be comfortable so that because we are controlling the situation. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. And your book has some exercises and some reflections on things we can do to help ourselves move through that, do that differently and or not stop doing that and get to know ourselves better. So what are some things that you suggest that we do to sort of start examining how we think and what we really think and how we really peel back those layers and start being true to ourselves?
Yeah, well, one of the things I think is so important to just mention is that like the biggest gift, so I ended up doing all the work that I outline in the book Relationship Ready because I was desperate and devastated by my relationships with men. And although I got to do that work and eventually I went back to dating and then eventually I met my now husband, one of the biggest gifts, that was a huge gift, but one of the biggest gifts that I received was finding myself, discovering, you know, that people pleasing was making me miserable and ruining my relationships, and then building a group of women around me that I started to practice not people pleasing with, that I started to practice just being myself with. So it's like I would not have been able to show up in my relationship with my husband now as it was when we were dating if I hadn't already practiced being myself, setting the people pleasing aside in a safe space with a group of women who loved me, you know? So like at the time I thought, oh, I'm going to do this work around men and relationships so that someday I can have a sustainable, you know, so that someday I can have a boyfriend, you know? But the real gift was like, I did this work around men and relationships. I developed this group of women that are like my dear in my heart, you know, and I got to practice with them all these things that were really scary to practice with my now husband, but I can do them now because I'd been practicing them for so long. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. It does make sense. And yet sometimes women are resistant to connecting with other women because they, and I think you talk about this in the book, about being a guy's guy versus a guy's girl versus a girl's
girl.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, I was definitely one of those women that was like, oh, I'm a guy's girl. And there were a couple of reasons for that. You know, one of them was that I liked unavailable guys. So a lot of times when I was dating unavailable men kept me really safe, or pining after unavailable men kept me really safe. So a lot of times when I was like, oh, I'm a guy, girl, what really was going on was I was hanging out with all my friends' boyfriends, which is creepy. You know, like I acknowledge it in the book, it's creepy. It's, you know, whatever. But it meant that I had to be like very low maintenance. I had to be one of the guys. But the trade-off was like, you know, they felt like I was one of the guys. I got a little nickname, you know, everyone was like, oh, you're so cool. And of course I was like kind of always pining and hoping that one of those guys would someday turn to me and go like, oh, my girlfriend's so high maintenance. You're really the true love of my life, you know, or whatever, right? Which never happened. But the other piece of it is that, like, I liked attention from men. There's a reason I'm a guy's girl, or I was a guy's girl. I liked attention from men. Men are no less petty than women are. They're just as petty. They're just as gossipy. It's exactly the same. But it's like I was lying to myself about like why I was a guy's girl. I was a guy's girl because I liked attention from men. So what I ended up having to do in doing this work around men and relationships, I ended up having to set some boundaries around the men in my life. The woman that took me through it was like, look, you are very much affected by the attention that you get from men. And so if you have any hope of having different relationships in the future, you really can't be getting all this attention from these guys. So you need to let anyone you're talking to know that you're taking some time off from talking to men so that you can focus on doing this work, which is one thing. I mean, I like really threw up in my mouth when she told me to do that. Like I was like, oh, I do not want to do that. But I believed what she was telling me would make my life different. And so I was willing to, you know, text those guys and say like, look, I need some space in order to do this work. The other reason I was willing to do it is because I really only thought it would take like 30 days. And it ended up taking me 11 months to do all the work that's outlined in the book and to change my perspective around men and relationships. But yeah, so that was the first step, was just kind of like putting up some boundaries and then learning to live with the fact that they were respected. That also sent me into a total tailspin. You know, like I grew up in a rom-com culture. I love, you know, all the Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks, You've Got Mail, all of those movies. And like, I really always felt like if I set a boundary with you and you didn't trample it, that you didn't love me.
That's interesting.
Like, you know, I'm supposed to set a boundary with a guy and then he's supposed to like show up at my work and send flowers and like get me out of a jam and win over my family. I mean, that's what happens in all these rom-coms, right? Like, isn't that what's supposed to happen? So I was like totally shocked when a number of the men that I texted to say, hey, I'm doing some work, I got to take a break from hanging out, they were like, cool, like, let me know when you're done. And I was like, what?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I didn't like it. I was hoping that my boundaries would get trampled, you know, but I learned a lot about like healthy boundaries when I did this work and realized like, oh, this is what it means to set a boundary. And even the next kind of level up to that was like, I learned what it meant to have integrity, because previously in my life, I would set a boundary. I can't see you anymore. You're no good for me, whatever. And then 3 minutes later, I would send a text like, oh my God, this is so hard. I need you to know I'm struggling with this so much. Right. Like, oh, if I'm a woman with integrity, then my words and my actions line up. So if I say to you, hey, I need to set a boundary here and I actually can't have any contact with you while I'm doing this work, then my action is that I don't have any contact with you. I don't initiate any, you know? And that was like totally mind-blowing to me to discover that integrity meant that my words and my actions lined up.
Now, as you talked earlier about both of your parents having addiction, I'm going to say issues with alcohol, but I mean, they were both in active addiction. And in fact, it took your father's life. So as what we call a CODA, or adult children of alcoholics, right? No, that's not CODA. What is that? Is that CODA? I'm getting
ACA.
My acronym.
Well, there's ACA, adult children.
ACOA, adult children of alcoholics, ACOA. Sometimes we see that, you know, as an acronym, on the internet or whatever. So I don't know how much work you've done around that, but I'm curious, do you see a connection between your dad, your relationship with your dad, maybe any unfinished business about how you feel about that and how that related to men? I mean, we don't have to go there if you don't want to, but I'm just curious.
No,
that's something that started to kind of make sense as you have all these aha moments.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's really great about, I have also, ACA is another one, or ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, is another 12-step program that I have kind of like drifted into a little bit, but not done the whole program. So I just need to kind of preface this with that. But they do have a book that their work is based off of called The Struggle for Intimacy, which I read that in sobriety, and that book outlines like 13 different characteristics of adult children of alcoholics, and it literally made me scream into my arm like every time I read. You know, I was like, I just couldn't believe its accuracy. The good news is the work that I've done in recovery and with therapy, like a lot of those things don't really ruin or run my life anymore. I can't remember a lot of them off the top. I can remember one, which is that adult children of alcoholics are over responsible. You know, I used to think that I was responsible for everything.
Well, and it's so interesting where you talked about when you were a teenager, you were like, okay, I don't want to be like my parents. I can see this is, they're struggling, this is hurting them, so I'm going to be good. And I think as parents now, and I know you have a stepdaughter, we all want good kids. And so how do we know when we look at a kid and say, oh, they're a good kid, they're doing all right. But how do we know when they're really struggling or when they're using their goodness to try to overcome something? I guess that's something that we all, talk about that for me.
I'm like, when you find out, will you let me know? Because I have no idea. I don't know. I worry about that all the time, about the goodness, you know, about like kind of do that thing that I did to you, that over-responsibility, that like that drive to achieve, kind of covering up substance use. I really don't know. I guess the reality for me is like, you know, when I was still at university, my dad was still alive. My mom was 4 years sober. I had gotten into this habit of like, I was drunk dialing my mom basically at, you know, I'm like 21 years old. I'm drunk dialing my mom and she's 4 years sober. I mean, how horrendous, right? How embarrassing. But eventually she finally said to me like, look, you cannot stay in Pittsburgh anymore. And she just like, she had a cut, you know, she kind of like created a consequence for my action. And the reality is when she said that to me, I thought for sure I was going to end up going to rehab. I really felt like, oh, she's going to come get me from Pittsburgh. We're going back to Iowa and we're going to rehab. And she didn't extend that consequence. So she basically just came to get me from where I was living and was like, okay, now you live in Iowa now, you know? And then I did a geographic, I moved to Denver and just kept doing the same old stuff. But I agree with you. Like, I don't know how we know that. And it does make me like hyper aware of that stuff.
Let's talk a little bit about your relationship with your mom now that you're both in recovery. And she was really, she was really there for you, but she also let you walk your walk and wait till you were ready. How have things evolved over the past 8+ years?
Yeah, I mean, that is actually one of the greatest lessons that I have to offer to parents of, you know, people who are struggling with alcoholism is I know that she did a lot of 12-step work of her own around, like, what she could control of my behavior and what she couldn't. And I know that she was a really great kind of attraction, not promotion, to 12-step recovery. She never suggested that I do it. But when I was ready to do it, I knew that it had worked for her. It gives me a lot of hope that, like, our relationship has healed tremendously. Part of the original wound that I had, that relationship had sustained, was this suicide attempt of hers from way back 1997. And I was really angry and resentful about that for so long. I drank at that for a really long time. And then in sobriety, it's just been so beautiful. She had made amends to me before I got sober, but I got the opportunity to make amends to her. And what I really love today is that like 8 years in, we speak a lot of the same language. You know, we both have kind of some daily non-negotiables around meditation and seeking a spiritual life. And she's always been, and especially as I've been sober longer, she continues to be like a great sounding board for me, you know, and kind of her first questions are always like, look, can you control any of this? You know, all of this is probably out of your control. Really, the only thing you can do is like stay sober and pause, you know, because I'm somebody who like, I want to fix it all, you know, that's very codependent. I want to just like swoop right into fix it mode instead of being curious, instead of pausing when I'm like all wound up. I just want to like swoop in there and fix it. So she's been a really, our relationship has mended in a beautiful way. And I do have a younger brother. He drinks, but not alcoholically. So that's been really interesting. Sometimes he's like, oh my God, like you guys speak your own language. And like, I don't even know, you know, and I'm like, well, you're always welcome, you know? And also like my relationship with him has mended really beautifully too. So, but it took longer than I thought it did. I think that's been the most challenging part is that it's like, oh, okay, I got sober and now I'm 6 months sober and now my family relationship should be perfect. But the reality is like, it takes a lot of time. You just kind of keep showing up. You keep demonstrating physical sobriety. You keep demonstrating living amends. You keep sending cards on birthdays and, you know, showing up for stuff. And then like the time passes and the relationships mend and we learn to show up with one another more authentically. And I think with my mom, that's the thing I really, really love is that, you know, there's really nothing I can't talk to her about. I sent her a copy of the book, which has a lot of explicit sexual stuff and not, I mean, I guess I would say explicit sexual stuff in it. And I wasn't too worried about her reading it because she knows, I know that she's heard a lot of stuff from a lot of people. I know there's pretty much nothing that I can there's pretty much nothing that I could say to her that would make that she hasn't heard before or that would cause her to have any judgment, you know? And so I really feel very safe with her, which is a gift.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really great. Before I let you go, I just want to talk quickly about sort of those God shot moments. One of them is that your sponsor ended up being the lady whose racquetball sign you were walking past all the time. But also that, you know, that kind of guardian angel cab driver who helped you figure out where you were and was helpful and compassionate towards you without being, I don't think, pitying or condescending at a moment where you were pretty raw and vulnerable. So having had some pretty neat things happen in your own recovery, do you, I don't know, do you recognize yourself as being kind of a guardian angel for others, or do you try to reach out to others as a way to give back some of that goodness that's come your way, or how do you view that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, wow. I haven't considered that question before. One of the things I know is I'm really open about my sobriety story because I really think that it's pretty relatable. And also that, you know, if I can help anyone who's struggling with this disease, like the craziest thing about alcoholism is that like it doesn't have to ruin your life. And yet for so many of us, we're in such denial about it that we have to hit some pretty, you know, stuff has to happen before we come willing to change our minds about it. So I just kind of feel like, you know, I do actively work with a number of women in 12-step recovery, and that not only helps them stay sober, but it helps me stay sober. I'm reminded of what it's like to have a year or, you know, to have 187 days of to feel frustrated with it, of to feel like you're not making enough progress with it. And I get to remind them, like, look, any day, look, I come from a long line of hope to die drunks. You know, all my grandparents died of their alcoholism. My dad's dead from his. My mom's 23 years in recovery. Any day that I can get through the day sober is like a W in my win column. And some days the bar's that low, right? Some days it doesn't matter that I snapped at my stepkid, that, you know, I ended up going into work late, you know, when I used to work in Cubicle Life, that I made a bad decision. It's like, look, if I can just stay sober today, that's a win. Because I truly believe that, like, in the universe I'm in, the universe can work with any decision I make. There are literally no wrong decisions because the universe can deal with any of those decisions as long as I'm not drinking.
That is a great place to end our discussion today because that is what it all comes down to. It's one day at a time. And, a sober day is a good day. Tell our listeners how they can find you, reach you, hear your podcast, and read your book.
Thank you so much. Well, like I said, thank you so much for sharing your platform with me. I am on Instagram. I'm at honeybee52. It's just the letter B. I am on Facebook. You can find me there, Heidi Bushy. You can find me on my website, which is www.heidibcoaching.com. And the book, there's a link to the book on the website. That's probably the easiest way to get there, but you can also find it on Amazon, and I'm on Amazon. I should be on all the Amazon platforms now. So, I should be on Canada. I know I'm on Germany, UK, US, all that. So that's all there. If you're in Portland, I offer a monthly workshop on the relationship ready material. If you are struggling with your relationship, I also have an online course. I turned it into an online course that's on my website. And then finally, if you just want to know a little bit more about like what I'm about, I have a new podcast called The Relationship Ready Podcast with Heidi B, and it is streaming on Apple, Spotify, you know the drill, all those places.
That is so wonderful. Heidi, thank you for sharing your story and your time with us today.
Such a pleasure.
And everyone, thank you all for listening. It is great to have this community really of listeners, and it is wonderful when people step forward from the audience and say, hey, I listened to the podcast and I'm happy to tell my story and share it. And Heidi, you're one of those people, and I really, really appreciate all that you do. That's all for this week, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to the Bubble Hour. Take good care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
I did that, not proud that that was me. And when I face it, I take back a little dignity. Not looking for excuses, I just want to be free from the power of weakness head on me. In a dark corner is I'm